Okay, so that's my time. Let me just move straight on to talk about this actual physical system I'm going to be talking about for the majority of this seminar. And that's the following simplest shear flow case where I've got two parallel plates and I'm shearing them across each other with a constant differential velocity. These are the equations. I'm just going to deal with an Navier-Stokes equation with constant density. The only thing to really note here is that I've non-dimensionalized them using diffusive timescales, so that puts the Reynolds number in the boundary conditions. A little bit non-standard, but this actually is quite nice later on. So the only thing to really take out of this overhead is that the Reynolds number is in the boundary conditions rather than in front of the diffusive term. Okay, so one of the issues I want to address, well, this is a busy overhead that I'm going to gradually work through. This really, as you can see, also has been magnified a number of times, that's why it's a bit grainy. But this comes out of a recent paper by Nicodemus, Grossman, and Hothouse in 1999. And I'm going to keep on coming back to this plot, so I'm going to show it to you now. This essentially summarizes the present state of affairs vis-a-vis rigorous upper bounds on energy dissipation in this configuration. So on this axis here, we have the energy dissipation in units of V0 cubed over D. D is the separation of plates, and V0 is the differential velocity between the plates. So these are in viscid units. Okay, so a Kolmogorov scaling, for example, would be reflected by a horizontal line. In other words, the dissipation ultimately becomes independent of the Reynolds number along the axis. Okay, so that's a crucial thing to bear in mind here. This line is the dissipation of the laminar solution, which is just a linear shear between the plates. And this we know from laboratory experiments, and perhaps numerics now, basically becomes unstable at about 1400 in these units, or 350 if you define your Reynolds number in the other way. And so essentially the flow leaves this laminar profile around here, and this is some experimental data. I'll talk about that in a moment. This is the best bound we have, as calculated by Nicodemus, Grossman, and Hothouse in 1998, using the Dorian-Constantine formulation. And as you can see, it levels off large Reynolds numbers. So this essentially is saying that the upper bound on the energy dissipation as a Kolmogorov sort of scaling becomes independent of the Reynolds number. Now this other blue dotted line is the prediction out of an alternative formulation for finding this maximum dissipation you can get in the system, and this goes back to well, ultimately Malkus, but Howard and Busser essentially formulated the problem, and this tries to estimate the upper bound from below. So it's strictly not an upper bound, but we now realize that these two approaches are complementary, and given the same physical information they produce the same bound. So this is why this blue line actually is slightly below the true bound, physical information I'll tell you about in a moment, and this black line is strictly above. So we know that the true bound asymptotically is level with the information that I'll tell you about in the next overhead.
Can you perhaps also comment that the blue line has an error, and that the error bound of the blue line are such that the black line is included in the error bound?
Well, certainly this isn't a true asymptotic result, but I don't know if you can assess the error in it. I know Grossman
says 20%. I mean,
I don't see how he gets that result.
Yeah, I don't know. How do you come up with 20%?
Well, the last I heard was 10%.
Oh, 10%. But how do you come up with 10%?
When did they cover your number?
It's
asking
dollars,
yeah. But you can actually get this resolved. I mean, I didn't really want to go into this, but all right, we will. There's two limits. This is obtained through a multiple boundary layer analysis, and I'll actually come to an overhead that describes that in a little bit. And what you need is you need a distinguished limit to get a true bound, where you take more and more boundary layers as the Reynolds number increases. And that gives you this result. And that's not strictly asymptotic because the boundary layers don't differentiate. They only differ by a scale of 4, factor of 4. But in fact, you can just take fixed number of boundary layers and take the limit of large Reynolds numbers and look at those limits individually, and it gets you the same answer. So I think this result is actually quite good. And the recent realization that this number must strictly be above this number makes this quite good justification for thinking that Bruce's multiple boundary layers are pretty accurate. Okay, so what's the issue in this talk? Well, the issue is, are these upper bounds a true reflection of the ultimate scaling for dissipation in this configuration? In other words, if we go to high enough Reynolds number, does the data level off? Or does it tend to drop down? And you can see it's not really very conclusive here. Is this trying to level off, or is there a gradual decay? And I think it'd be true to say that two options are really considered as possibilities, either that it does level off, or there is a logarithmic decay, 1 over log r squared, and that comes out of Prandtl's mixing length closure ideas. So really, that's one of the fundamental issues, is trying to find out whether this reflects the true scaling of the fluid. Okay, what I'm going to do now is I'm just going to give you a quick flavor of what Booster did. I think I've already given you that, actually. But then I'm going to move on to talk about the Dorian-Constantine formulation and show how we can make some progress in that.
Could I ask for a clarification? Yes. Epsilon is a function of Z, is that right?
No, it's the global energy displacement averaged over the horizontal. Mm. So it's integrated over Z.
Yeah, but if you want to talk about Kolmogorov scaling, there is a Z-dependent scale of turbulence in the flow.
Yeah.
So why would you be interested in volume integrated dissipation?
Well, you're interested in it because it's the one thing.
Well, it's the thing you want to ask.
Yeah.
For the experiment.
So I said.
Basically, how much power do you need to keep the configuration?
How does epsilon denote drag?
That's one. Epsilon divided by U is the drag force. Watch yourself.
It's the dimension of drag, but I don't know what.
Yes, true. F times U is.
Epsilon is the energy that is eventually required to maintain the valve in motion. That's what the study.
Okay. All right. Okay. So, just to give you an idea of the information that goes into.
We borrowed our symbol. We borrowed our symbol.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, you've got to keep on with rotation actually, because I do vary, I've noticed. I go from D to epsilon. So. Okay, this is just a quick overhead to show you essentially the information that goes into these bounds, and it really isn't that much, in fact. This is the way Bucer initially set up his problem. He had a kind of Reynolds decomposition where he had a mean flow, and he assumes everything has reached statistical stationarity, so his mean flow is independent of time. So there's no time in there. And he admits the possibility of a fluctuation field which vanishes over averaging over horizontal planes. Okay, some constant Z planes. And this is the problem he solved. It's a kind of a classic Euler-Lagrange approach. You have your functional, then you have your constraint, and this is what they are. For example, you impose the total power balance here, and this is what tells you the dissipation balance is shear of the wall, the work done by the shear of the wall. Insists that the flow is incompressible, insists that the velocity satisfies the boundary conditions, and also a further constraint that the mean momentum balance is satisfied in the direction in which the plates are sheared across each other. Okay, so this is a z-dependent constraint, and this is just a global one, a scalar constraint. So this is actually quite important, this one here. And this is actually a non-trivial.
So the last one, x hat is.
X hat is in the direction of shearing, so your preferred direction in which you're moving the plates. Okay.
What is the bar over the first line?
The bar means averaging over these red horizontal planes, so over X and Y basically.
And as I've already alluded to, the solution of this problem is non-trivial, and this is actually one of the things that makes the problem a bit quite intriguing. You get non-trivial structures coming out of this, and this is Bruce's multiple alphas or multiple boundary layer structure. The mean flow is coming out of the board, and all these vortices are aligned with the shear, and you get a hierarchy of scales. So the non-trivial kind of fluid structures come out of these problems. And I might come back to that later on. So let me make a clear statement of what I'm going to try and talk about now. I've laid the context. This is really the purpose of this talk. I'll tell you now so you know where I'm trying to go. The purpose is the following: to show that if a flow has no energy in horizontal transverse length scales smaller than the Kolmogorov length scale, then this tells me that the dissipation must decay algebraically by the power of 1/7. Now let me just make it clear what I mean by horizontal length scales. Well, this is exactly what you do if you were trying to simulate this flow numerically. You'd set up your velocity field in this kind of Fourier transform notation. What I'm trying to say here, in fact I'll go through a more general result, but this is obviously the length scale of interest. If I cut off my wavelengths, my wave numbers above a certain wavelength, what's the effect of that? Well, I'm going to show that if the cutoff is the Kolmogorov wave number, then this necessarily means that dissipation must fall off algebraically. This is interesting because nobody, I think, has really entertained this possibility before in this situation. In other words, you get algebraic.
So if it would be 10 times Kolmogorov, it would have be the same. It would be the same exponent,
yeah.
Different effect.
Yeah.
So the point is, it has to cut off somewhere. Where it doesn't matter.
What has to cut off?
Well, the spectrum has to be.
Yes.
Cut off somewhere.
Yes, basically,
it would only determine what the prefactor is, but the scaling.
Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to actually express, you'll see, I'll show this on an overhead next. I'm just going to say that the cutoff is some power of the Rouse number.
Yes.
And then I'm going to get a more general result. And then if you solve the two back to give you the Kolmogorov length, you get so.
Is it going to be possible, and we're all jumping ahead here, but what if you don't cut it off but let it die exponentially at some rate determined by the
curve? Yeah, that's interesting.
If you let it cut it off physically reasonable.
Yeah, if you were to cut it off exponentially, I'm sure you could get a result. I'm not sure it would be this one.
But it'd be the same.
Would it be the same?
It would just change the prefactors. Yeah, it would just change the prefactors.
You think you still get the sum?
Because you get all the moments of time, right? I mean, if you have an exponential cut with a scale, you know, like this, then you're still going to get through the moments.
You're going to
get the same kind of thing with different
prefactors. Maybe I can tell you the answer tomorrow. I don't want to commit myself with that
technique. The more problematic is going to be this epsilon is the average of the whole box. Whereas the Kolmogorov scale that may be relevant is corresponds to maximum dissipation, which doesn't necessarily scale with the way the average dissipation scales.
That's right.
So you might have a little problem there.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean,
yeah, that's a very important point, because most of dissipation is in the layer very close to the wall.
And it will scale differently.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I guess my point, this is why I really wanted to put it out here right now and early, is that this is what you probably do numerically, right? This is how you choose your transverse resolution.
Absolutely.
I mean, I'll come to an example at the end. I'll actually do the same thing for convection. But I'll see if I get that.
Okay, so that's where I'm trying to head. Let's now see how I'm going to get there. And to do that, I need to talk a little bit about the Doering-Constantine formulation. Charlie Doering and
Peter Constantine introduced in 92. Based on some work by Hopf. This is really the crux of the method. Now you'll see that this looks very similar to what Bucer used, the classical Reynolds decomposition. And in fact it's very different, because where the Reynolds decomposition is a unique representation of the velocity field, this is non-unique. The reason being that I no longer require my fluctuations to be meanless. Okay, so in other words, if you give me a velocity field, I can find a whole set of different phis and nus to represent those velocity fields. This is going to be called the background field, and the only thing you really need to know about the background field is it must satisfy the boundary conditions. So this basically picks up all the forcing, leaving the fluctuation field to have homogeneous boundary conditions.
Right, so how does this go? Well, it's very simple, really. You take
the scalar product of the Navier-Stokes equations with this fluctuation field, which can have a mean. You do manipulations, you get this. I mean, nothing more has gone into that.
Then you use an identity.
And this is just the effect of putting this into there and doing integration by parts once. And then I'm going to mix them.
And if I mix them, I get this, or I'm going to do a long time average too. The long time average kills this term. You can prove that that goes away. And you're left with this exact statement.
Now, the way it's being designed, or written, is that all the nus occur over here. All the time dependence is in the nu, and that's over here. That's why this is not integrated over time. And this tells me how my dissipation goes.
You have not yet assumed stationarity, right?
No, in this approach, yeah, nice point. You don't have to do that. What you do is you take long time averages.
But you have to assume the time independent. Right?
No. The point is that this is the only way the time derivative comes in. And then when I do a long time average, you can prove that this vanishes into one point. Okay.
Only the integrand is boundary, is that right?
Yeah, this is the global energy dissipation.
So the time average is zero, not for sure.
What does that mean?
Only the integrand is bounded, the long term average of this derivative is zero.
Yeah.
Okay,
well this is an exact statement, and the next line I uncover will not be. The point is that if I can find the most kind of dangerous value of this integral over here, in other words the minimum value of this whole thing, then I can get a bound, because in the dissipation will be less than this minus the smallest possible value of this whole integral. Okay, so this is the statement. All right, so this is now a steady problem. In other words, I'm just looking at the worst possible scenario for this integral, and I can write that down. And the one criterion, and that is that the inf exists. The inf might not exist.
Well, it might be more than infinity.
Yeah. Yes.
Which just would be a useless.
Right. Yeah. So there is a restriction on the background field phi that I will be interested in. I'll only be interested in phis such that this inf exists. Okay? And you can see that when I write this down, my nu is completely unrestricted, except it must be incompressible and it must satisfy the boundary conditions. So at this stage, I've lost quite a lot of information here, all right, but I am gaining a very strict bound.
How does this differ from simply assuming your fluctuation field is stationary in the statistical sense? Because in stationarity would it basically imply that an error exists, which is what we seem to assume.
Oh, right.
The limit of t goes to infinity 1 over t integral dt that's the definition of the time average.
Yeah, this is a good point, too. Essentially, what's going to come out of this is the maximum dissipation is given by steady solutions in every state.
Statistical state?
No, steady solution.
Okay.
Steady solution. So that's why this is what's happening.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah,
that's what actually comes out. Any other solution has less dissipation.
Yeah, that comes out of it naturally.
That's what we were arguing about on that way today.
In fact, you can make a stronger statement. It's not clear that it's a steady solution, but what happens is that essentially what you're doing is your dynamical constraint is a long time averaged Navier-Stokes, right? That is not the same as a steady Navier-Stokes. But any variational solution you find using that long time averaged Navier-Stokes will be a solution of the Navier-Stokes steady, precisely because this term goes out. So it's not a priori clear that a steady solution will give you the maximum dissipation. But if you use the long time average Navier-Stokes, then it's inevitable. That's a non-trivial point. Okay, getting back to this thing here, it looks a bit horrendous, but it's actually not too bad. It's kind of quadratic in Nu. These are the two quadratic parts and there's the linear part. So in fact, you can work out the infinium of this as follows, and so this is finding the infinium, putting it together with this term, you get this nice expression, and then the condition for this infinium to exist is now written in terms of this quadratic part, and essentially you're just requiring this to be positive semi-definite. Okay, and then again you've got this general, just these very loose conditions on what nu can be. And let me just go back to the degeneracy here. Why am I able to do this? And essentially what I'm trying to say here is I'm just going to choose a phi arbitrarily, and then whatever nu is, this will be bigger than the dissipation. Well, it's at this point that the degeneracy in this representation is crucial. In other words, I can choose a phi, I can always find a nu to bring me back to any physical field that I require. So this is what allows me to choose a phi and then just be interested in the infinium of that. Any physical field is still encapsulated within this state. Okay?
A is just a parameter so far?
Yeah, A is a parameter. In fact, I'm not really going to talk about it too much, but you actually optimize over A too.
I'm trying to connect up to the
jargon
we're more familiar with. It. Aren't those terms just in the turbulent lexicon when we say dissipation, production, and probably transport?
They look like it, but the thing you've got to be careful of is that...
Well, that was a little strange.
That nu doesn't have... at this stage it does have...
It doesn't have a non-zero mean.
Yeah, but it does have at this stage, actually. It doesn't at this stage.
Yeah.
But you can... Yeah, you can peel it off. Basically, you find out the mean part when you find this infinium. It all gets lumped into here. So at this stage, these nus are meanless. So this looks like a Reynolds.
Yeah, it looks like a Reynolds stress, production and distribution.
Yeah. There's close similarities between this and doing energy stability analysis.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, if I went back to that
overhead. I went back to this master overhead, then in fact the first place that this band leaves the lambda plane, that's precisely the energy stability boundary. So that's when the bound starts actually to take effect. Up to this point the laminar flow is unique, and obviously a maximum and minimum dissipation. At this point here the energy stability, which is 82 in these units, then you have to have a bigger upper bound. Right, so what I'm going to do now is talk a little bit about
this spectral constraint. This is the crucial thing that allows you to design phi. Because what you want to do is get this to be as small as possible, you want the best bound, but you want a phi that satisfies this spectral constraint. Now if you look at this, this is the crucial observation, this is the term which is sign indeterminate. Okay. And you also have to realize that phi has to go between minus a half RE and plus a half RE. So in other words, I've got to have non-trivial phi dash. Phi dash has got to have a non-zero value somewhere in the domain, going from minus a half to a half. And I've got complete freedom to specify where it goes from minus a half to a half. But I want to design that change in phi to be where nu one and nu three are small, to minimize the effect of this term. In other words, to control it. And this naturally suggests putting all the variation of phi dash into boundary layers, near the walls where nu one and nu three must vanish.
So the way to proceed is to design a background field which looks like this.
And the arguments I've just tried to present naturally suggest using a boundary layer structure. Okay? So what this is where we do it, we just have piecewise linear. Phi dash is zero in the interior and it's large in these boundary layers, and they're parameterized by this length scale delta. And there's a competition. The dissipation of the background field goes to infinity if delta goes to zero. But if delta gets too large, then the spectral constraint is violated. Essentially, the thing you have to do is choose a delta in between. And just by simple functional analytic arguments, it turns out the delta is always 1 over RE. This isn't too much of a surprise. It just basically tells you that your boundary layers have got to be 1 over RE.
Why is there... Are you just picking this for simplicity? Because it would seem like you've thrown away the most important piece, which is the logarithmic region that buffers those two, because that's where all the dissipation is. At least that's the traditional view.
At this stage, all you're trying to do is get an upper bound.
Yeah, one okay. Upper bound. But you could do better, right?
Yeah, well, I'll discuss this as you go down here.
Okay, good. Okay.
Using just this trial function approach, you can find this scale, and then your energy dissipation must be less than some order one quantity. So this is the original straight line that I showed you on that summary plot. This is a Kolmogorov sort of result. Waving aside any issue of whether Kolmogorov is valid or not, just pointing out that this is a Kolmogorov result. In other words, energy dissipation becomes independent of viscosity. Now, of course, this was the original result of Dorian Constantine in 92. Then some other people tried to make this a little bit more sophisticated and took better and better ansatzes for this. And obviously you can see that essentially all that's happening is the numerical value is changing. And then finally, Nicodemus had all kind of grasped the nettle and took a very sophisticated trial function here. Basically took a polynomial here, matched onto a linear profile and a polynomial of high order, and essentially matched n minus one derivatives here. And they got this value, which is one, which is 0.0109. So this is the result that I showed you on the plot. So that result there.
Could you comment on why this 92 is very close to the energy limit in the Reynolds, for the Reynolds number? You see what I'm saying? The energy theory will give you a critical Reynolds number
of 82. 82.
82, okay.
Yeah, this 92 has no...
89 is a different number.
Completely different number. This is just like a...
It's so close, though.
No, I just forget that. Just look at that number. There's no connection. Yeah, I'm sorry I didn't write that down.
Our equivalently, this figure you can see is flat at about the same point where it takes up. That's what I was asking.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So it's not so unrelated in some sense.
No.
It's a lot more work to compute the 92
than it does to compute the 92. Yeah. I mean, it's like two JFM papers, 30-page JFM papers to get this figure.
Now, let me just also say a little bit more about what they did. Let me just say a little bit more about the spectral constraint of the stage.
This is really the issue. This is what you want. And you can turn, because it's purely quadratic, you can turn this into a rather nice linear operator. And all you're really interested in is making sure that the spectrum of this operator is positive semi-definite. Okay, and what you do is you just put in nu like that, parameterized by a horizontal wave number, and just search. Okay. So that's what Grossman, Nicodemus, and Holthaus did for the first time. All the previous estimates had been functional analytic on this, just basically trying to bound this quantity and deriving conservative bounds because of that.
Now what I'm going to show you next is what they found in terms of what were the crucial wave numbers that came out of solving this problem, and this is crucial to understanding what makes the whole thing tick. This is a plot from their paper
of the crucial wave numbers. So in other words, as the Reynolds number increases, these are the two, well, initially one, but finally two wave numbers that emerge as being critical in the spectral constraint. There's an interesting bifurcation here, which remains unexplained, but I think it's pretty clear why these two wave numbers come in. Now, essentially their background field has two scales. There's a boundary scale and then there's an interior scale. And these wave numbers reflect those two scales. So this is on the order of the interior scale, which is order one. And this wavelength here is basically the inverse of the boundary layer scale, so it scales with the Reynolds number. Okay? And because they only had two, seems to be two scales within their calculation, they got these two wavelengths. So the red line is the line that gives you the previous result they produced, published in 1998. But of course, it suggested another question to them at the time, obviously, and that was, why should we allow these wave numbers? Aren't they far larger than we really expect in this system? Because they're smaller, they're larger than the Kolmogorov wave number. So why don't we redo this calculation, but now add a rather ad hoc constraint, that the wave number cannot exceed the Kolmogorov wave number. Let's just kind of build that in. And it's actually non-trivial to build it in because it has to be through an iterative procedure. Because when you're finding your bound, you don't know the energy dissipation to put into the Kolmogorov formula to give you the maximum wave number. So you have to iterate a number of times. But this is what they found when they did this, that the wave number would now scale as RE.73.
And this is what they also found.
So the red line is without this Kolmogorov extra constraint, and then the blue line dotted is what they found locally around 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6. So the important thing to take out of this is that they found that the energy dissipation band is now decreasing algebraically by a small exponent of minus 0.08.
Now, if you this 0.08 comes from what? From
the numerics.
0.73 is related to 0.73 somehow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But this was the very point. And if you read their paper, it's not particularly clean. You don't really quite know what's coming out of it.
And if I took 3/4, what would I get here?
Well, 3/4, you'd only get k equals 3/4.
Is the non-intermittent.
Then epsilon would be order 1. So if the energy dissipation is order 1, doesn't depend on the Reynolds number, then the Kolmogorov wave number is RE to the 3/4, 0.75.
Yeah. And what will that correspond to? Is that a flat line? No.
Yeah, it's the red one.
No.
Well, hold on,
No.
It's
got to
be
unity.
Yeah.
That result is given by going like Reynolds number to be called unity. That's the red line.
Yeah.
And this number, this thing you have, Reynolds number going to 0.8, is corresponds to 0.73. I'm only wondering what it will be.
Well, that's what I'm going to explain. The point is, you say that this is a good point. These numbers don't really make much sense. But they're all local, they're all local exponents of what they saw at 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6. They tried to extrapolate their data, and you can see they found a rather dramatic change. So their exponent, their best guess of the exponent, went up to 0.18. So at this stage, it wasn't really clear whether they had an algebraic decay or something else. You know, this really wasn't consistent enough. Okay.
What's the limiting step in that calculation? I mean, they're doing some numerical minimization.
Yeah.
So it's a number of things they're willing to minimize over or something?
The limiting step is a resolution. What you've got is you've got to solve that
linear eigenvalue problem. But this is basically developing boundary layers of order 1 over RE. Mm-hmm. So at 10 to the 6, they've got a boundary layer of 1,000. That ultimately kills you. They might have got to 10 to the 7, I don't know. But they quote their figures around 10 to the 6. And it's a 1D calculation, but even so, the boundary layers are getting so thin. And of course, you've got to do this search over all these k's, too.
So, really motivated by those sort of figures and all the uncertainties surrounding them, I decided to do something a little bit more general. So I said, well, let's see if we can deduce what the effect would be of a minimum transverse length scale like this, asymptotically, so in other words, in the large RE limit. So let me just explain what I mean here. Lambda is just an order 1 coefficient. And then the scaling comes in here, and alpha is some number bigger than 0. If alpha equals 0, then you're back to the original calculation by Nicodemus, the red line where the dissipation is order 1. So anything with alpha bigger than 0 will impose an extra restriction on the flow. And this corresponds simply, turning it upside down, to a maximum wave number of that form. Okay.
Now you can play the same sort of game. You can say, look, all I'm going want to do is just find an upper bound, so I'm going to try this nice simple functional form and see what the effect is on delta. If I'm going to get reduced energy dissipation, I better have less constraints on what delta can be. And it turns out that if you have this constraint, it allows you to use extra information about the fluid flow at boundary. It turns out that you can use this constraint as well as the fact that nu 3 equals 0. And this turns out to be crucial, absolutely crucial, to allow you to make progress. If you do that, then you find that delta can be larger. There's less restriction on the flow because the spectral constraint that you're having to enforce is weaker, because the spectral constraint only has to hold over a smaller set of velocity fields. Now, which
you're putting it, this is a kinematic boundary condition.
This is the effect.
The derivative of the norm.
The normal
cross
the boundary. Yeah.
Okay, so
this is just through incompressibility.
No.
Okay, so then that's
dv dy.
Dv dy to you guys. Okay.
It's not ambiguous at all.
Well, the thing is, I like to use nus because they have means. So I like to keep that in mind, that's why I don't use these.
That falls right out of the Taylor expansion at 12.
No, this is just incompressibility.
And incompressibility, yeah.
Just incompressibility.
The other way around.
So if you follow this through, and I didn't really want to present all the nitty-gritty at lunch, but this is the result you get. You get the band now has to be less. Don't really worry about the numerical coefficient. R A to the minus R. In other words, this is saying that you've got algebraic decay if you add this rather innocent looking constraint.
Now, before I go back to tying it up with the work of Nicodemus et al., let me just say what happens in the Howard Boothe problem, which, recall, is complementary. So in other words, really, the solutions
should be the same. Well, they are the same. Now, you'll remember that I had a hierarchy of boundary layers aligned with the direction of shear. That was the optimal solution. And a key feature of this optimal solution is that the streamwise rolls at the boundary have an aspect ratio of 1, order 1. So in other words, in Bruce's original problem, the innermost boundary layer has a size of 1 over RE, and the wave number is order RE. That gives you aspect ratio of order 1.
If you add the smoothness constraint, then you can see immediately what's going on. These rolls get squashed. And now the innermost scale is 1 over RE, 1 to the power 1 minus alpha. The wave number is this by initial assumption, and the aspect ratio is RE to the alpha. So this is really keying down what's going on. These are far less efficient at transporting momentum than these. And this is what's cutting down the dissipation.
This is a result of a detailed calculation.
Yeah. And this is the result you get. So this is an underbound of the true bound using all the constraints plus the top scale. So why is this important? Well, it tells you that you've captured the true scaling of the band in your new variational problem. So you bracketed the true band by two trial estimates. So in other words, the result is this. Adding the, whereas before I had 0.01 over here and then Grossman's 0.0109. Now this is the equivalent expression. This is produced within Boothe's problem, so this is an underestimate of the true band, and this is an overestimate. So this tells me that I've captured the right scaling. So the true band in this new variational problem really does go as RE to the minus alpha. So now if I go back and say, well, what happens if L is the Kolmogorov length scale? Then it means solving these two problems, which is at least of your problems at this stage, and you get the value of alpha equals a seventh, and then you get K max to be RE to the 5/7. So this compares relatively well with what Grossman found. This is a 0.73. What I'm saying is it should be 0.714. And this should be 0.14. So it doesn't look too good at this stage, but if you look at their extrapolated values, you can see this flips to the other side of the seventh, and this tends to go towards 5/7.
I must have somehow missed how you got lower bound on this, the left part.
It's a lower bound on the upper bound.
It's a lower bound on the upper bound. It's a lower bound on the upper bound. Otherwise it really would be good.
That's this makes better sense. Okay.
So let me just put up a summary slide of what we've got here so far.
And what I'm really doing here is I'm almost doing the opposite of the kind of minimum channel effect where you try and chop off the higher letter, the small wave numbers. What I'm doing here is almost coming from the spectrum in a different direction. I'm saying, look, if I've got a flow, I'm just going to chop off K above a certain point. And this is the result that you can prove rigorously. which seems to be non-trivial. So that's the clear statement of what's going on. So I've taken away Bruce's resolve so as not to confuse things. And so this is the implication. So, what does this mean? Well, the first statement is if the energy dissipation really does behave on an order one fashion, or we do have logarithmic corrections, then this is immediately telling us that we must have length scales down to 1 over RE. That's the implication.
Mm-hmm. Irwin, how did you manage to reverse the logic on this?
Well,
let's say that if you cut the length scale, it implies this result.
It implies that result.
Right.
It must contradict the first statement.
Yeah. Okay, got it. Yeah. Just making sure you aren't pulling a fast one.
Yeah, thank you.
Some of us are slower than others.
Right, so this is the other implication. Because this is exactly what happens in numerical simulations. You know, you have to limit your truncation at some point. And this is what happens. If you're using Kolmogorov length scales through your code, the best you'll see is RE to the minus 7. So you'll never see Kolmogorov scaling results. If they really are there, if you don't resolve length scales right down to 1 over RE.
And then finally, this is something that's kind of fascinated me, actually. You can do some numerical experiments. You can say, well, look,
what happens if I artificially truncate my horizontal scales? What sort of energy dissipation scalings am I going to get out? Are they going to reflect my bounds? Or are they going to reflect my bounds modulo logarithmic corrections? Or are they not even going to come close to my bounds? So this is actually quite interesting. So, for example, what I started with a friend in Washington is choosing alpha to be a half. If you choose alpha to be a half, that tells you the only length scales you're going to allow are going to be order one in your flow, in the horizontal. This tells you that the dissipation must go as RE to the half. So what we're doing at the moment is we're running many, many simulations with this artificial truncation in the horizontal direction and seeing whether we're actually going to see this band, logarithmic corrections thereof, or other scalings.
I have some preliminary results of that. I was in Washington 2 weeks ago.
State or D.C.?
Seattle. And Peter Smith got so interested that he immediately started running a job. I mean, these jobs take a day.
So it's basically 14 points, I think. And this is the data. So let me explain a little bit what's going on here. This is the energy dissipation scaled in visage units. This is the Reynolds number, and this is dissipation in plane Poiseuille flow with this artificial truncation. In other words, we're only including 10 wave numbers. We don't increase it with Reynolds number, so this is an experiment. We have as much resolution as we need in Z, or the vertical. And the question is, are the numerics respecting this band? And this has been
okay. Let's just finish with what these results mean in convection. Well, in convection, the present state of affairs is this.
Using a global power balance, a global entropy balance, mean heat balance, and these two kinematic constraints, the equivalent of the 0.01 and the 0.0109 are these two results now. You can see they're just as close, and they tell you the classic or ultimate scaling regime that many people think exists. The Nusselt number going as RE to the half. If you now put in a smoothness constraint like that, so gamma is now alpha, I don't know why I've changed, but I did, then you get that. Same sort of thing, so you can bracket the bound in the same way using Busse's formulation or the Dorin-Constantine formulation, and you can see you've captured the right scaling, and gamma basically tells you how much you're off the ultimate scaling. So, in particular, if you use that length scale, which is something I got out of a paper by Bob Kerr in 96, this is what he used to do his simulations. He used this Kolmogorov scale based on this balance between the Nusselt number and the energy dissipation.
That's how he chose his cutoff rate?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, actually says in his paper, this is what I used. Mm-hmm. Then you know that gamma equals a seventh. And you know that the maximum heat flux you're going to get out of his simulations, wherever they are, however large the Rayleigh number is, it's going to be 3/7. Now, luckily, this is above 2/7. This is what he was interested in. But I think if you'd have talked to him, he'd have said, well, if RA got even larger and larger and larger, I don't know what I would have got. Right? I now know he couldn't have got above 3/7. So there's no way he could reach the ultimate regime if it exists using this.
Okay, and all I would say, I guess, is
where's Bob when we need him?
Yeah, that's right.
He's going to be here in 2 weeks. Or he'll be here for the convention.
Well, at this stage, I would put up a plot like this
of the fact that there might be this ultimate regime, and this might go as RA to the half, but I get the impression this is old news here, and everybody's been talking about this anyway, so. This is from Sumeria in the Nature paper. The fact that people might start to be seeing this ultimate regime, the jury's out. So.
Okay, I guess I'll stop there.
I think the main comment I would make is the same as I already made, repeat myself. That the minimum Kolmogorov scale you have to have is should correspond to the maximum dissipation in the flow, and that's not the same as the global. And I tried to work out, as you were talking, how it would change. I'm not sure I have it right. Then I think you might of course not see that big a difference from global.
Well, that'll be interesting. Question, that is not the way people do simulations, unfortunately.
Yeah. I'm not sure how, we might figure it out next week. We have all these simulations people coming.
Just going to say, you aren't going to be here
tomorrow. No, I'm just here tomorrow.
I would love to hear their reaction to this.
Mm. Well, you have a tape. Send me a tape of replies.
The other thing is, there's of course no reason to think a Kolmogorov would be valid for a shear flow, where the boundary layers may get very thin, but still the contribution to the dissipation might be comparable because they're getting thinner and the gradients are correspondingly getting larger.
That's right.
I mean, there's a kind of limit on the Grossmann result in some sense that can't go beyond the point because it's hard to stop.
Yeah, I mean, this is why I did the general thing, and I basically put Kolmogorov up just to give an example.
It's very nice, yeah. I mean, it's a plausible thing to try, actually.
Yeah.
I might comment from the point of view of analysis. One thing that's nice about this result, when everything's stripped away, is when you look at, I think, implication number one, when he turns the logic backwards and says not B implies not A. This is a way of mathematically getting a handle on taking global quantities and from information on global quantities being able to say information on local quantities, which is usually the other way around. You have to say something about local quantities and then you move it up to statements about global quantities. But this is nice to be able to back this around. So the experimental, for example, the experimental state of affairs right now in shear flows is that epsilon is order one within logarithms. It's not decaying like a power law. That's what experiments seem to suggest, which means that probably the smallest scale is as small as Reynolds minus one modulo log.
Which experiments are talking about?
Dan Majors.
Yeah, Dan is going down, right? I mean, you know, bands result in
going down. Yeah, it fits with the law. It's consistent with the law.
Yeah, well,
you don't know.
I mean, great power of the law. I mean, who knows about this?
That's right. So the experiments right now are not conclusive enough. Putting bounds on the alpha. But the fact is that mathematically one can do this is a nice step forward.
So the history of experiments on pipe pulse and boundary layers is that the higher the Reynolds number of the experiment, the lower the power you need, which is a pretty good clue that it's a logarithm.
That's yes.
Well, there's it.
Which is again consistent. Yeah. Okay.
That's if you have roughness in your wall. You can't just do it.
Right.
This is the dissipation.
Yeah, your bound doesn't care whether it's rough or not. Right?
The Rayleigh numbers have been pushed higher beyond the ones you showed in this slide, and it doesn't seem like there is any asymptotic range.
Charlie was telling me this at lunch, yeah.
And also, if you look at the energy dispersion which you get integrated one, which is Nusselt Rayleigh minus one, or Rayleigh times Nusselt minus one,
yeah.
Whatever, that is not half, it's not going like Coleman graph anyhow. I mean, so it's below, if there is a power law at all, and the Detlef might want to remark that if there is a power law, if there is a power law, it truly is below Coleman graph. So if that is true, it would suggest to me that the thermal boundary layer there might get thinner and thinner, but its contribution to the dissipation might not simply vanish as a power bar or something like that. It might just stay a fixed fraction, in which case nothing works.
For the remark case, I would also expect a Prandtl number dependence. I never understood how in these strict estimates you always get rid of the Prandtl number.
Neither do we.
Anyway,
it's
a marathon. I know. It's very frustrating. Yeah. You always lose the Prandtl number dependence. And from the physics, you would expect it.
Absolutely.
That's right. You need rotation or something like that to actually get it in or mean flow. As soon as you have a mean flow, you can get it in. But all these variational problems give you optimal solution with no mean flow. You can then stipulate one. You can say, well, what's the effect of having a mean flow? And then you have a Prandtl number dependent.
And what you could do, you could say, okay, let's assume a large scale wind. I mean, Sweeney may not like this, but it's tilted a little bit, so yourself, and then you will somehow have one direction which is preferred, and you will apply a large scale wind, and then assume a profile. The velocity profile, which is similar to Schiff.
It's basically the same thing as this. You impose a non-rigorous but plausible constraint. For example, I might say, well, what happens to this problem if I insist that I have a mean flow? Then what are the implications? You can go down that path. And that might be a very good path to go down. This seems to indicate that it is. Because I make an assumption. You know, I don't know whether it's true, you can't deduce it from the Kepler equation. But then I get a very clear implication, and I can test this.
The nice thing about all this is it's mathematically more solid than like the one calculation you might make according to what Detlef might suggest.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you might get a more correct result, but you are not.
I can clearly envisage imposing a mean flow, getting a Prandtl number dependence, and then saying, well, if you've got this sort of mean flow, which scales it this way, then the bound is changed in this fashion. And that's the way that this is basically signaling that's probably the way to go.
Sounds like no one is disagreeing with
me. Okay. Yeah, okay, good. Good place to stop. I'm out of here.
if anyone wants to join us for dinner, I make reservations for a pita at the restaurant here. I can increase it. But if anybody is going to want to join us for dinner at the beachside restaurant tonight, just let me know. And I'll... Okay. Is this your end?
I'll just put this up. I made an overhead just in case. This is just advertising some related work by Zhang Ming Meng, who's rather than focusing on the small scale, has actually started looking at tangential derivatives of the velocity. And it's got some new bands. Of course, the problem here is we don't know anything about the tangential derivatives of the velocities yet in the band layers. But you know, there is other work going on in related directions. I think this is going to come out in Physica D soon, isn't it? Yeah. So, you know, there are other approaches to be taken too.
Okay.
All right. Thanks very much.